Hello, and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy. We strive to relate, educate, and innovate, one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Our podcast explores topics that relationship-based therapists care about. In addition to featuring unique conversations and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Divorces are often messy, involving court dates, significant time and expenses, a lot of hassles, both for the client systems that we work with and also for us as MFTs. This is especially true for divorcing couples who can't agree on what to do. They need intervention of attorneys and judges to resolve their disputes. But what we're going to talk about today is collaborative law. The defining characteristic of a collaborative divorce is that parties and attorneys agree not to litigate. So it's an out-of-court legal process whereby your client will have a team of specially trained legal, financial, and mental health experts all working together in unison in a safe and amicable environment, guiding the couple to develop options for reasonably dividing the marital estate while helping them develop the necessary skills to live independent of one another and in many cases share the children and maintain the integrity of family relationships, because a divorced family is still a family. In this episode of the AMFT podcast, I'm going to be joined by Dr. Randy Heller to discuss both the important similarities and the differences between collaborative divorce and traditional divorce mediation, which you may know more about. Both of these things, by the way, are in the scope of our practice of MFTs, but not necessarily in the scope of our competence, meaning even me, someone that works with a lot of divorcing couples, I love this information today because it tells me what I need to level up on in order to make good referrals and potentially do more of this work. We're also helpful, we'll learn today, to attorneys. We provide a critical resource by helping them understand clients' emotional triggers, fears, and concerns. And we provide crucial assistance in the settlement negotiations when we identify the emotional, psychological roadblocks to settlement. Also in the episode, in addition to talking about the similarities and differences between collaborative divorce and traditional mediation, we're going to talk about how we as MFTs can increase our scope of competence in this area. And even if you don't see yourself being part of a collaborative divorce team, as it's outlined today, how you can make inappropriate referrals so that our clients that are good candidates might find a collaborative divorce team. Dr. Randy Heller received her doctorate in family therapy from Nova Southeastern University. She's an LMFT, a certified family court mediator, a qualified parenting coordinator, as well as the founder and clinical director of the Family Network. She's a clinical fellow and an AMFT approved supervisor. And what she's very proud of, and we'll talk about today, she has pioneered the first and only course of its kind in collaborative divorce for both master's and doctoral students at her alma mater, Nova Southeastern University, in the family therapy department. I learned so much from Randy, and I hope you will too. We will be back after this very informative interview. Dr. Randy Heller, welcome to the AAMFT podcast. This is a topic that we get a lot of requests for. Today, we are going to talk about MFTs understanding the world of divorce mediation, collaborative divorce. Many times we work with couples, and it used to be in our field that if you could not save a relationship, that was considered a negative outcome. We don't think that way anymore. In fact, many MFTs work people to dissolve in a healthy way their relationship, and part of that is a mediation process and a collaborative divorce. So a lot on that today. But first, Randy, we always like to know about our experts. So tell us about your MFT origin story and specifically your interest in working with the divorcing couples in mediation and collaborative divorce.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for having me here today. I'm very excited to share all of this information with all of you. My own story and how I began doing this work, I wrote my dissertation on this topic, and I'll tell you a little bit more about it later. However, what I write in my first chapter is my why. And really, my why starts with my own family of origin. As we all know, as MFTs, there's something that prompts us to want to do this work. And truly, I come from a legacy of divorce that goes way back to my great-grandparents, who didn't officially divorce, but they did separate. And what we come to understand in working with families who divorce is that there's oftentimes generational patterns. So my great-grandparents had conflict in their marriage, and my grandparents had conflict in their marriage, and my parents divorced. And actually, the way I talk about that is that when my parents divorced, it was in the early 70s. And when they divorced, divorce was a really shameful thing. And unfortunately, I remember I was 13 years old at the time, getting on the school bus and being really fearful that somebody would know that my parents were divorcing. And it was really a sad thing for me because I didn't know how people were going to view me or my family at that point in time. And so ironically, when my parents divorced, then the rest of the block got divorced. I guess they gave everybody permission. However, the reality is that my parents didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to help me. They didn't know how to handle themselves. And they really didn't know how to move through this process in a way that was going to allow myself and my brother to thrive. And instead of perpetuating that pattern, I really wanted to learn how to do it better and differently than they. And the reality is, I got divorced. And when I got divorced, I was dedicated to doing it better and different so that my daughter didn't experience the same struggles that I did. And so truly, that is how I got involved in this arena and knew that there had to be a better way to do this than the typical litigation process, if you will. And we're learning so much about the impact of divorce on children and families. And the reality is that we used to believe that children who came from a divorced family were going to be quote unquote damaged goods. And as we know, as MFTs, what we look for, what we search for are what good can come out of this? What are the positive things? And I really appreciate what you said, Eli, about the fact that we as marriage and family therapists don't necessarily have to have as our goal keeping the family together or keeping the couple together. As a matter of fact, that's not my goal at all. And I tell every couple who comes in to speak with me that my goal and my role is not to keep them together. My goal and my role is to help them to figure out where do they want to be and how do they want to live their lives and help them find a path to doing that. And in actuality, that's what I'm doing in this process, helping them to find a path to do it in a better way, in a way that isn't going to create a scenario where their children are damaged goods, if you will. What we actually now know from my research and some research that has come before me is that children who come from divorced families in reality can be better off in an ironic way than children from intact families. And when you think about that, it makes perfect sense because anybody who learns how to move through adversity and anyone who learns how to adjust to life's challenges in a reasonable way is going to thrive in life. And so we're really teaching parents how to help their children to do this so that, again, the generational patterns do not persist, if that makes sense to you.
Sure. And many of our audience out there will have worked with a divorced family system, but let's differentiate that from really what we're going to focus on today. So please define divorce mediation and collaborative divorce for our listeners.
Okay, great. So mediation and collaborative divorce are often confused, so I appreciate you asking me to define the similarities and the distinctions. So when a couple decides to divorce, there are many ways they can go about it. So I'm going to give you a little bit of education about that. There's what we call the kitchen table divorce, where two people can come together, sit down, decide how do they want to divide their assets, their liabilities. We call that their relational estate, and how they want to share their children and what they want to do about that. Unfortunately, most people, though, who are getting divorced really can't sit down together and talk about that without a neutral person to help them. Because what I always say in these processes is that if people who are divorcing knew how to communicate effectively, solve problems, co-parent their children, and really understand each other's perspective, they probably wouldn't be getting divorced. And so we start with that premise that these people need assistance and guidance to help them to move through. Again, a kitchen table divorce is one way they can do this, which usually isn't that effective because, one, they don't know how to talk to each other, and two, they really don't understand the legal ramifications, the financial ramifications, and the relational ramifications of being divorced. And truth be told, it is a benefit to couples to have professionals who have an expertise in these three areas, because I will emphasize, divorce is a legal, financial, and relational issue, mostly relational, then financial, and then legal. And so we have to help them with the expertise that we have. So again, going back to your question, the next way that people can get divorced is by going to litigation. And that's what the world knows about, litigation and how two people fight it out and how attorneys represent each party, each entity of the couple, and they try to prove that the other one is wrong, that their client is right, and that they should get everything that they want. And I said that in air quotes, get everything that they want. And litigators oftentimes will convince their clients that if they go to court with them, they will, quote, get them whatever it is that they want. And that really doesn't help the family to sustain after divorce, because if you think about it, they're fighting it out in court. There's gasoline on that fire, and they are angry at each other. They are resentful of one another, and they really can't find a way out. The other problem in litigation is that you have a judge who makes decisions about what should happen with this family. And the reality is that judge doesn't know the family, doesn't know the children, doesn't know the dynamics. What they're looking to do is settle the matter. And so they make a decision. And typically, people think that all the rights of the wrongs that have been done to them will be justified and dealt with in a court of law by a judge. But the reality is that the judge comes in, utilizes the law as a premise, if you will. However, really judges and makes decisions based on their own experience, their own bias, their own awareness, and their own beliefs, not really necessarily considering your family system. And the reason that I preface my now explanation of mediation and collaboration with litigation is because mediation and collaboration are two what we call alternative methods to resolving disputes. So they come under the umbrella of what we call ADR, alternative dispute resolution, and they are entities unto themselves. So mediation, there are many ways that people go about mediating. For an example, in the state of Florida, you are required to mediate before a judge will even hear your case, even if you're in litigation. And so what you need to understand about that is, when you're mediating as a byproduct, if you will, of litigation, you will be with a neutral mediator who will facilitate the conversations and attempt to engage in problem solving with a divorcing couple. However, the litigators are still in the room. Again, fighting for who's right and who's wrong, or they're in the background and there's a lot of noise about who is right and who is wrong and who should get what and who should do what to whom, etc. So that is mediation as a byproduct of litigation, which is not necessarily alternative dispute resolution. The big distinction is when you're in mediation and what we call a pro se mediation, where it's two people who are divorcing and there is a neutral mediator who could be either a lawyer, a mental health professional, a financial professional, or truth be told, almost anyone who is going to step in and help this couple to communicate and solve problems. When you have that neutral person, you've eliminated the noise of the divorce war, if you will. So in that regard, it's a very beneficial process where two people really are encouraged to communicate about their perspectives, what's important to them, what they hope, what they wish for, what they're afraid of, what their vision is about their future after divorce. And we're helping them to do that in a safe container that is confidential, does not go, the products of mediation, the work product of mediation does not go into a courtroom ever. And so there's a safe container to, in some ways, air differences. There's a safe container to communicate your perspective. And a mediator, a trained mediator, will facilitate that.
This idea of pro se mediation, if I hear you correctly, the couple, in this case, the divorcing couple, has elected that and they do not bring their legal counsel into that mediation session. Is that correct?
Yes.
That's very different when you go in as a part of the legal divorce proceedings. Like the prelude is we're having this mediation and we're going in with our lawyers, and no disrespect to any lawyer in our audience or someone with a close family member or friend that is a lawyer, but I always tell couples when I'm meeting with them, they're going through this. It's like, much like you said about the judge, the lawyer's job is to protect the individual. Whereas why I think MFTs are so suited for this mediator role, as we'll talk about today, because we're playing the long game. We know, especially if this couple has children, that they are going to have to work together to communicate better, that we're, again, playing the long game. And the more acrimony or discord, well, a lawyer might like that because it could be a billable hour. They want the most for their client. They're not necessarily thinking of the whole systemic picture the way MFTs do. So I think that's a pretty important distinction when the difference between pro se and electing it versus being contested or part of a legal divorce proceeding. Now, as you were saying, talk us to the difference between mediation and a collaborative divorce.
Sure, I'll do that. And though before I do, I want to make one point. So oftentimes when people are in mediation that's mandatory as a, as I said, byproduct or prelude, as you said, to litigation, what's happening is, one, they're either checking off a box that's required by the court, or they're doing it without a lot of skin in the game, if you will, because they know if we don't agree, we'll just go to court and we'll let the judge decide and we'll fight it out. So the mindset is different as well. And as you said, so importantly, the attorney is only advocating for one entity of the system, right? So in a pro se mediation, the significant difference, and I want to emphasize what you said, is that you have one neutral person who is trying to see the big picture, who is trying to address all of the issues, all of the perspectives that are happening simultaneously. And so to my mind, that's really a much more productive mediation. And the clients are there voluntarily. They have chosen this process. They have chosen not to go to court. They have chosen not to fight it out with attorneys. And so we still are tasked with teaching them a better way to do this. However, they're more motivated to do it in a better way because they've chosen it, if you will. Now, what I learned and the way in which I got involved in the collaborative divorce process was that I would work as a MFT. I'd work with couples and they would start talking with me about the notion of our marriage isn't working. Maybe one, maybe both would start thinking about divorce or talking about the next steps toward divorce or talking about how they would restructure their family. And I would sit with them as an MFT and I would help them to talk about it. I would help them to visualize a plan. I would help them to come to some terms, not an official role as a mediator, but as an MFT, helping them to communicate about an issue at hand, right? And we would come up with all of these potential agreements, if you will. And they would leave my office and they would say, oh yeah, I can do this. And our family's going to be okay. And our kids are going to make it. And we're going to be good co-parents, etc. Let's say that was on a Thursday. By Monday, I would get calls from them. I talked to my attorney about your plan. And my attorney says, if I spend more time with my kids, I would pay less. And if I had my kids more, I would get more money. And it became a transactional process. As an MFT, I decided I would become trained as a mediator. And as a mediator, I would then have the ability to work with couples, not therapy couples. And that's an important distinction. And we'll get to that later. But I would work with couples who would come in not wanting lawyers and they'd want to mediate and I would help them. However, what I realized is I could help anybody talk about anything. But what I truly realized is I did not know enough about finances, which are a big part of divorce. I did not know enough about the law. So I didn't know if these people were really coming to good, sustainable agreements. And so I felt almost in an ethical dilemma, if you will, because I was doing something where I could help them to come to terms. However, I didn't really know that the terms they were coming to was good for them and was going to be good for their family over the—
Back to your language, you were very comfortable working on the relational before your additional training. You were very comfortable working on the relational part of divorce. You were not as versed working on the legal or financial.
Absolutely not. And the important thing to note is as a mediator, any mediator, a lawyer mediator, a financial professional as a mediator, or a mental health professional as a mediator, we are not allowed to give legal advice. We're not allowed to give financial advice, and we must stay in our own lane, right? Okay, even though we're not allowed to give that advice, what lawyers do is they educate people when they're mediating. What financial professionals do is they educate people. As I do, educate them about the relational piece. However, I didn't know enough to educate them about the law and about finances, and nor was I supposed to, because ethically, that is not my lane, and it's not my training, and it's outside of the scope of my training. So with that said, at that time when I realized these conversations I was having with my clients were falling apart outside of my office when they did speak to their lawyers, I decided, wouldn't it be a wonderful opportunity for me to team up with financial professionals and attorneys and move these people through peaceful divorce? So the interesting part of that story is that I decided on my own, nobody told me to, but I decided I better learn more about this. I better learn more about the possibilities of teaming up with other professionals and moving families through divorce without going to court. So I started exploring what's out there to do this work, to teach me to do this work. And I went to a conference, and this is important to note. There's an organization called the Association for Families and Conciliation Courts. It's been in existence for a very long time, and it's comprised of mental health professionals, financial professionals, and legal professionals who are dedicated to moving families through divorce in a peaceful way. And so I went to their conference, and when I went to their conference, there was a process there called collaborative divorce. Unbeknownst to me, it had been developed in 1990, where there were teams of professionals moving families through peaceful divorce. So let me explain and define that more clearly. So on a collaborative divorce team, you have two attorneys, Each attorney is representing one entity of a couple. So there, you're addressing the issue of being educated and informed about the law and about the divorce process, if you will. Someone who's going to advocate for you. And then you have a neutral financial professional who works with both entities of the couple, looks at the marital estate that I described earlier, and helps the family to look at, okay, what is it that they have? How can they divide that up so that they can both live sufficiently and take care of their children? And how can they move forward in their lives? And then you have a neutral mental health professional, such as ourselves, who helps facilitate the conversation around the family dynamics, the family relationships, and also around these legal and these financial issues. So you have a collaborative divorce team. So now let's juxtapose that with mediation. In mediation, you typically just have one neutral professional. There is a movement now towards what we call co-mediations, where one neutral mediator will team up with a financial professional or a mental health professional to do something akin to the collaborative divorce process. However, there is one more significant distinction. Again, in the collaborative divorce process, each entity is represented by an attorney. You have a neutral financial professional, a neutral mental health professional generally on these teams. The caveat is, and the cornerstone of collaborative divorce, is we sign contract agreements at the onset not to go to court. So we are creating a safe container for everybody to work together, collaborate, if you will, on how to best move this family through, restructure their family, and make the agreements sustainable over time so everyone can live and move forward in their lives. And so that is a big distinction because, again, go back to a mediator. Nobody is being represented. Nobody has advocacy. And nobody has sometimes the support that they need if they don't feel like they know enough to make the decisions that they need to make when going through a divorce. Now, one more thing, and this is, I hope you're recognizing how complex this is. What happens in mediation is we oftentimes rep that each entity of a couple have what we call review attorneys. So what happens there is that the couple may come to an agreement with their neutral mediator, financial professional, and or whoever else is in the room. They may come to terms. And then when they go to their review attorneys, sometimes what happens is the very same thing that I described earlier, where the review attorneys will almost break apart all of the agreements. And as you said, Eli, in all due respect to the attorneys who are out there, that does create billable hours. And I would like to say, with respect, that the attorneys really believe that what they're doing is protecting their client, defending their client. Attorneys are trained in law school toward zealous advocacy. And that means that they defend and protect their client to no end. So how does that help the rest of the family system that experiences the fallout of that? So you don't have that in collaborative divorce. In collaborative divorce, everyone is committed to working toward settlement. Everyone is in a room together, as I described, creating a safe container for this couple and this family to move through divorce in an amicable, peaceful way. The other part is we're really teaching them the skills as we move through these settlement conferences. We're teaching them the skills that they don't have when they come to the process. And the other part about it is we are helping them to deal with the process of getting divorced, not as is typically the case in marriage counseling, not what needs to be in place in order for them to be able to live together peacefully, but what needs to be in place in order for them to divorce peacefully, raise their children peacefully, and go on to have better and different relationships in the future. Does that?
Yeah, you have so much great stuff there. I was taking some mental notes. Let's dig in. So now this idea of a collaborative divorce, which, as you said, has been in existence for over 30 years, and you are now well-versed in it, but it may be very new to some of our listeners who may understand a mediation. But this collaborative divorce, so we have two attorneys, we have the neutral financial professional, and we have the neutral mental health professional. Does this team come prepackaged if you are a potential couple looking for a collaborative divorce, or who assembles the team, number one? And then number two, Randy, tell us about how many times the team is actually all in one place to work together with the couple.
Okay, great questions. Typically, in each geographical region, we have what we call practice groups. So let me start with, we have an umbrella organization named the IACP, which is the International Association of Collaborative Professionals. And I urge any one of you who are listening to go to the website collaborativepractice.com and look for the International Academy of Collaborative Professionals. I actually proudly sit on the board of that organization. And the reason that I mention that is because we have a menu of all the different regions, and you hear international associations. So we are all over the world, and we are all over the United States and Canada. And we all have what we call practice groups. And within the practice groups, for an example, I'm in New York right now, and I sit on the board also of the New York Association of Collaborative Professionals, the NYAC. And within our organization, we have mental health professionals, financial professionals, and legal professionals who all work together. We all have very similar training, and we all process how to help people to go through these divorces in a better way. So within those practice groups, we build relationships, we get to know who we work well with. And so when a couple decides that they want to get divorced and they go to one attorney, let's just say, and they have searched us and they know that they want an alternative method to divorce, they may go to our website and they may connect with an attorney. And then the attorney may recommend other attorneys or the website so that the other entity of the couple can choose an attorney. Typically, what happens is that those attorneys will then select a few names of mental health professionals and of neutral financial professionals, and will recommend that they interview those, that the couple interview those people. And so the team is generated primarily through the professionals, but with the couple, so that the couple has agency in choosing who do they want to work with. Now, there are sometimes, because people who are going through divorce are so overwhelmed, there are sometimes that they will go to an attorney, and the attorney will say, I have this great team of professionals who I typically work with, and will make those recommendations. However, much like MFT, marriage and family therapy, this is a client-driven process. So we give them options on how they want to formulate their team and what the best way for them to do that is based on their individual needs. Maybe there are substance abuse issues, and maybe there's someone in our practice group who specializes in helping families where there are substance abuse issues, or even domestic violence, which is a hot topic, and we could do a whole other podcast on that. And how do we help these families move through, even if there is domestic violence? Or, you know, there may be very complex financial issues, so we select the financial person based on their knowledge and their expertise. So in these practice groups are different professionals with similar training and expertise, and then also specific training and expertise that may lend them to be the most appropriate professional to be on the team, if that makes sense to you.
It makes great sense. And when a team is assembled, again, will they all meet together? Will it be siloed? One of the questions we'll also have from our clients and from our audience therapists listening to this is the cost benefit analysis, having a contentious, legal, expensive divorce versus the probably more expedited, financially efficient, collaborative divorce.
But I love how you put that because that's exactly right. So great. How many meetings? Those are difficult questions. So I also have conducted additional research, and there is research out there on how long do these cases take? How many meetings? Who comprises the team? How much does this cost? And what we find is that there are generalities. However, as with couples counseling or family counseling, it depends, right? It depends on the clients. It depends on how willing they are to take hold of the skills that we're trying to teach them to not compromise, but I learned from a professor of mine, and I use this term all the time, stretch to meet the needs of the entire family, not just their own needs. How are they willing to communicate? How transparent are they willing to be? And so there are a lot of factors that go into how many meetings. I've done over 100 of these matters, and some of them I've done in 2-3 hour meetings, and some of them take months, and some of them take well over a year or more to do, depending on the personality dynamics, the issues at hand, the finances, how much support they need. And I'm not talking about financial support. I'm talking about professional support and help to go through this. But typically how this works, now, what I didn't mention, which is really important, is that we're on the front lines of couples who aren't making it. And so oftentimes these teams can be generated by the MFT working with the couple because they know the couple really well. So if they get to know the professionals in the collaborative communities in their areas, they can make great recommendations about professionals that they believe would be a good fit with their clients. So oftentimes if I'm working with a couple and they're starting to lean toward divorce, before one of them goes out and hires the most heavy-weighted shark litigation attorney, I'm going to start to talk to them about alternative dispute, the differences in mediation and collaboration that we've talked about today, the professionals who I know who may be able to help them, and I will generate a team that way. Typically, what happens when I am brought onto a team through attorneys is that I will meet with this couple first. I will meet with them together. I will establish the context of neutrality. I will discuss the process with them. I will observe the interactional patterns between them. And then I will go report back to the team and tell the team what I've learned so that we can develop a strategy to help these people to move through in the best way. I'll report on, okay, what are the dynamics between the family? Who seems more assertive? Who seems more subordinate? Is there a power differential? What are the children going through? What have the children experienced? What's the level of conflict? Has there been any domestic violence? Those kinds of things. So I have a lot of information up front that will assist the attorneys and the financial professional to prepare for our first team meeting. And we will know how to approach this couple so that we can be most cost efficient, most time efficient, and most productive. So there are times where we will meet as an entire team, and there are times where we'll meet offline, as we call it. So I will meet offline with two parents to help them to talk about and draft a parenting plan and a timeshare agreement. So they're not now paying each of their individual attorneys by the hour to discuss something that attorneys really don't have training and education and awareness about, parenting and timeshare and age appropriate timeshare for different stages that children go through. And so they're paying one person, not two people, to go back and forth with them and back and forth with each other. I'm doing it in a neutral context, helping them to talk to one another about that. So that saves time and it saves money. Then we bring that back to the full team, and the attorneys, of course, will review it with their clients and maybe comment on their thoughts about it. However, recognizing, again, it's a client-driven process. So these clients have agency over the ways in which they want to share their children that may be different than what the attorneys think they should be doing. And so how many meetings? It depends. How many hours? Typically, we don't go more than 2 hours at a time in a session. So what will happen is the team will meet before, and we will do what we call pre-brief, and we will strategize for how to talk about specific issues during a collaborative session with the couple. And then we will meet with the couple. So typically the pre-brief is about a half an hour. We will meet, we will strategize, then we'll meet with the couple. The whole team will generally meet with the couple. We will address the issues that are at hand. We have an agenda outlined already, and we will then help them to move through that. Those sessions are generally capped at 2 hours because it's very emotionally charged, and 2 hours is long enough before everyone really runs out of gas, if you will. And then after the session, the professionals meet again for another typically half an hour, and we do what we call a debrief. What went well? What didn't get accomplished? What are we concerned about? How can we address that? And then we may decide, okay, now the couple needs to meet offline with their financial professional and they need to discuss their budget. Now they need to meet offline with Randy and discuss how are they going to tell their children that they're getting divorced. So again, we're not always all together in a room. However, generally, we bring our work product to the room when we have it. So when the financial professional has what we call an equitable distribution chart and they have identified all of the finances and the budget, we will generally all meet together and discuss that because the attorneys need to be aware of that. I need to be there to help regulate the emotions around these financial discussions, and the financial professional needs to bring their work product and have this, lead this discussion. Or if we're discussing parenting issues, I will bring the work product, the parenting plan, to the session. The attorneys need to be there to weigh in on the maybe legal ramifications, if necessary, of the co-parenting decisions. And the financial person needs to be there because there are financial, let's just say, obligations that go along with parenting time. And so, as you can see, it's a series of offline and online meetings where we're either all together in a room, but we try to make it as efficient as possible. And if the lawyers don't need to be in my parenting session with them, they don't need to be in my parenting session with them. And the same is true for the financial piece.
Very many times we see divorcing couple, they triangulate a child, but many piece a therapist and a lawyer triangulated. In this model, everybody is starting on the same page. So even if it, as you said, starts online, everybody together, and breaks down to offline or the different parts of the collaborative team, it's still coming from one centralized unit. These four professionals working together in the best interest of the couple in a unified way, which I think is immensely necessary to avoid this triangulation and things breaking down. So you said also that the couple signs an agreement that they are not going to litigate. So let's say everybody starts in good faith and it is just not working out in this collaborative team. What happens if you hit a stalemate? Do you terminate the contract and agreement, or this is obviously a best case scenario? It works out. They have a collaborative divorce, avoid unnecessary acrimony, and kind of move forward many times as co-parents in a type of limited partnership, as we talk about. But let's talk about when the collaborative divorce does not work out and how you shift from that.
There are times it doesn't work, and there's a multitude of reasons for that. It's rare, though, I will tell you. We have our statistics say 96% of these cases settle. And so if it doesn't, what happens because of the contract agreement states, it's called the withdrawal provision, that if anybody chooses to opt out and go to court, then you lose your entire team. So you lose your attorney. They can't represent you in court. And you lose your financial professional and your mental health professional, and oftentimes any work product that you've already accomplished. And that provision really depends on the team and what they decide to do with that. So to my mind, let's say if a couple decides to opt out, but they've already completed their parenting plan, they've paid for that. They've invested a lot in that. So typically the teams will agree to give them that to move on. So there are times where people will opt out and they'll end up in court. But if they've had any resolution and they've come to any specific agreements, we will memorialize those and then they can move on. However, they do lose their team. So they lose all the money they've paid, they lose all their retainers, they lose their professionals, and they lose that safe container. And the irony is that the statistics will show that 98% of cases, even those in litigation, settle on the courtroom steps. So what I often say to these couples who are thinking about opting out, or these people, any entity of the couple who are thinking of opting out, the statistics will suggest that you're going to wind up back in mediation or in a process like this. So why not just stay in it and tough it out and work through it? And we're here to help you to do that. Again, to me, the withdrawal provision, which sometimes scares a lot of the attorneys because they don't want to lose their clients, if you will, to my mind, the best reframe for that is the withdrawal provision where they might lose their attorneys and they might lose the other professionals is the best leverage that we have to keep them motivated to work toward settlement.
To me, you're preaching to the choir here. I work with a ton of conflictual couples and they're headed toward divorce, and they many times have lots of resources and assets. And they spend a lot of time and money fighting about things and many times triangulate the therapist. So in my 24 years of practice, I have been subpoenaed many times for records or whatever. But, you know, often I say, and I've never had to appear in court because I know my legal and my ethics and the unit of treatment was the couple. And that's how it started. So unless both people gave a consent, which usually never happens in a divorce, I'm not going to release that stuff or certainly testify on one or other's behalf. So one of my biggest fears is getting triangulated into the legal system. But what you're describing now, I really like, because it's working with like-minded lawyers and financial people to avoid litigation. So someone like me would be much more interested in doing this than going down another route. And you also said something I think is very valuable for our listeners today. Even if you don't want to extend your scope of competence to do this type of work and get some of the training that you've had and you'll tell us about in a second, your ability as a point of entry to educate couples on this. Because if you're like many of our listeners, you don't even know what this is. And if you don't know as a mental health professional, you can't really educate your couples that this is even an option. And if they hit a lawyer as a first point of contact, probably, no offense to lawyers, as we've said during this hour, but a lawyer isn't going to suggest this either unless they're in one of these practice groups that's like-minded. So I think the MFT becomes very important in educating the couple to what their options are.
What's important for you to know as an MFT to our listeners out there is that even if you're not going to do this work, as you're saying, Eli, you want to be informed about it so that you can inform your clients. Because I will tell you, before I knew about this, the inclination was, I want to protect my client, right? I want to help my client. So let me send them to the sharpest attorney I know. What I've learned is I'm not helping my client that way because the cost is exorbitant emotionally, financially, and relationally. It just destroys your family. And so I'm not helping them. I thought I was, but I'm not. And so becoming well-versed in this, Number one, you can be the point of entry, as you said, Eli. But the other thing is, if you are trained in this process, and we'll talk about how you do that, if you are trained in this process, what you also can be is a consultant to our team. So oftentimes I'll work with one entity of a couple and they're really not ready to go through divorce. They're really emotionally devastated. They're still wanting to stay married. They can't come to these meetings and be regulated. And so I'm going to send them to a therapist. I'm going to suggest therapy because what we didn't get to and what's critical, and I hope we can get to the ethical issues because there are many. As I'm on a team, I need to identify that as a problem. So if a person really can't move through these meetings in a productive way, I want to send them to a therapist. I will not send them to a therapist who hasn't been trained in this process because, again, we run into the problem of a therapist thinking they need to protect their client. They don't understand the process, so they're informing them, if you will. And so I will only refer to MFTs who have been collaboratively trained and or trained in mediation and alternative dispute if I'm going to consider sending a client of mine who's in the process to a therapist. So even if you're not interested in doing this work on a collaborative team, if you're trained, you will be the referral source. You can participate in our practice group meetings. You can become entrenched in our community, and you can be an ideal referral source, which is really key. I started to tell you earlier, Eli, that out of my dissertation, I wrote a course at Nova Southeastern University. I've been really blessed to be able to teach this called Collaborative to Divorce to MFTs for the last 10 years. And every time I begin a semester, I asked the students, what made you decide to sign up for this? And they would say, we know that divorce is out there and we want to help these families and we like to collaborate, but they didn't even know there was a specialized process called collaborative divorce. And so educating you all as MFTs about this process is critical for the clients in a multitude of ways. So I would just like to describe and summarize for you, if I can, Eli, the similarities and the differences, which are very succinct.
Please, and then get to the ethical considerations as well.
The similarities and the differences between mediation, a pro se, let's focus on pro se where there's no lawyers, a mediation and collaboration. So the similarities, both processes are solution oriented. So I'm going to be speaking your language now. We're not living in what were the problems in the marriage. We're living in, how do we help you move through a successful, peaceful divorce? What needs to be in place in order for you both to leave this process feeling like you can move forward in your lives and you're still whole? So both processes, mediation and collaboration, both are non-pathologizing. We're not judging people. We're not deciding who was right and who was wrong in the marriage, who caused this and who has to pay for it, and how do we rectify those rights and those wrongs? We're not looking at that. We're looking at how do we help them both to take responsibility for their part in their decision to divorce and move forward. So that's important. Also, in both mediation and collaboration, we are understanding that each person in the room, lawyers, financial professionals, mental health professionals, and the couple have perspectives that are happening simultaneously. So everybody in the room has There are multiple perspectives happening simultaneously, whether in a mediation or a collaborative divorce. And our role is to help everyone to communicate those perspectives so that there is a global understanding of people's interests. So that's really important. The differences between mediation and collaboration is that truly in collaboration, you have more support. So when somebody calls me and they want to understand what they need, I look at how much support does this family need? Do they have children? Do they have a large marital estate? Do they have high conflict? Is there substance abuse? Are there mental health issues? So is this something that simple and one neutral person or a co-mediation can support this couple going through? Or do they need more? And if they need more, generally, we refer them to collaborative. Now, the difference between these alternative dispute processes, which will lead me to the ethical issues, the differences between this and marriage and family therapy. First and foremost, you are not doing therapy. You are not doing therapy as a facilitator in either one of these processes. You may be using every one of your skills that you've gleaned in your education and your training to facilitate communication, to problem solve, to help them understand multiple perspectives that are happening in the room. However, you are not doing therapy. So what you do is you identify the issues that are getting in the way of the resolution process, and you become a referral source, and you provide referrals to help them. The other significant difference between this and marriage counseling, if you will, or family therapy, you're not repairing. You're not doing the repair. What you're really doing is helping them to get the resources that they need to heal, whatever that looks like. And you may have conversations with them about that, but you are not facilitating that. So that's a big difference. You're also helping them to restructure and be a different kind of family. So you're not working with them on what needs to be in place for us to be a better married couple. You are working with them on what needs to be in place to restructure our family so we can all sustain. That's important. And what I focus on with these couples is we are dealing now with the business of co-parenting. It's no longer about, I don't agree with your approach and I don't agree with your approach. We're going to fight over how we raise our children. No, it's more about the business of a co-parenting and what needs to be in place when your children are transitioning to two different households and having two different experiences. How do you help them to thrive in the midst of those differences? So it's very different than marriage counseling, because the reason I mention that is because oftentimes couples will be resistant to having a mental health professional on the team because they'll say, we've already been to marriage counseling and it didn't work, and that's why we're here getting a divorce, and so we don't need that person. However, it's really important that we help them to understand that this is a different role that we're in. We're using our skills, our assessment skills, our communication skills, our case management skills. However, we're doing it for a different purpose and in a different way. So ethically, this is really important that you understand. Again, you're not doing therapy. You're not treating issues. The confidentiality and transparency issue is one that really most clinicians struggle with. So in counseling, we are ethically responsible for providing our clients with confidentiality. However, the cornerstone of this process is transparency. Remember, I said we're all sitting in a room together and we're all discussing everyone's issues. And I, as the mental health professional on the team, I have to share what everybody discloses to me with the entire team in those strategy sessions so everybody knows what we're dealing with. Now, if someone tells me, I explain that to my clients, and if they tell me that they have another relationship outside of this relationship, and that other person is now bearing their child, I need to bring that to the collaborative divorce team. However, they may tell me I can't. So if they tell me, listen, I'm going to tell you something, but you can't tell the team, and I believe that it's relevant to the divorce process, which of course this example is, then I will have to tell them that I won't tell the team because you're telling me not to, and I'm still bound to my ethical code. So if you tell me I cannot be transparent, even if you've signed that release, if you are revoking that release and telling me I can't share it, I won't share it. However, I'm going to tell the team something has come up and I can no longer work on the team and I will have to withdraw. And so confidentiality and transparency is a very tricky fine line that we're walking, and we have to really be well versed in the protocols for that. Also, as you alluded to before, Eli, and I appreciate it, there are a lot of clinicians who graduate and they think they can do this work. However, it's really outside of the scope of your training. You, again, will use your training and your skills to facilitate these processes, but there is a lot to know about the nuances of people going through divorce. And it's really key that you do get the training that you need, stay in your own lane, not try to do something that you're not trained in, understand how to work with attorneys, understand how to work with financial professionals, understand also the, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a financial person, but I am well versed in some of the tenets of the law that people have to understand as they're going through divorce and finances. And so we really have to understand the scope of the process that we're in. And again, I find that a lot of clinicians graduate and they think, I can do this work. I know how to do this. And you really don't. You need specialized training.
You've educated us today that to work with certainly divorcing couples in both a collaborative divorce and a pro se mediation is within the scope of our practice as systemic therapists, marriage and family therapists, but not in the scope of our confidence. So yeah, that's the last question. I wish everybody, I would certainly take your class at NOVA, and I've learned so much today. But if I want to continue this work, a listener out there, I work with these couples, I not only want to be able to educate couples and refer them, but I actually want to be able to do this mediation and collaborative divorce work. What does the training look like? Where do people go? Because this is not taught, as someone has taught in MFT programs for the last two decades, none of this is taught in MFT programs, which is a shame because it is so relevant to what we do, especially those of us that work with divorcing systems. But how am I going to follow up on our talk today, and where do I get trained in collaborative divorce and mediation?
What I suggest is that you start by going to the international organization, the website, as I said, collaborativepractice.com, because that is an international website and it will tell you the various practice groups in your jurisdiction, wherever you are in your geographical region. And what you will do then is you will connect with a practice group there and you will find out the trainings that they're putting on. So typically to become trained in this, and I always say my students who have a full semester course in this are definitely better trained than people who take the required two-day, what we call it, it's a two-day interdisciplinary basic collaborative training. So you will find out from the practice group in your region, the trainings that are happening in your region. However, one of the silver linings of COVID is now these trainings happen online all the time. And there are some wonderful training groups that are out there doing virtual trainings for you to access online. So that's number one. But you do have to train and you have to take the two-day interdisciplinary training before you can even contemplate doing this work. Most practice groups require that you're trained before you become a part of their practice group. So that's one. Same is true for mediation. If you want to become a certified mediator, then you have to take, typically it's a 60-hour mediation training. And so you would need both to do collaborative work. The 60-hour mediation training and the two-day basic interdisciplinary collaborative training. You would need both of those things, and you can find trainings for mediation all over the web. Just look up family mediation training, and you will find that. So you go to the IACP website to learn which jurisdiction you're in, which geographical region has a practice group in your area, and they will tell you where the trainings are. Typically, they're also listed, the virtual trainings that are around and the ones that you can take. There's a wonderful training group called the Tampa Bay Collaborative Trainers. They do virtual trainings all the time. But again, there are a multitude of in-person or virtual trainings out there. So you get trained in mediation, again, which is a typically 60-hour mediation training in mediation processes in order to become credentialed as a mediator, you typically have to observe or participate in mediations before you actually can do your own. In the collaborative process, we have people who come in and observe as what we call scribes, note takers, who sit in on the cases and observe and learn from each other until you feel comfortable and competent doing this work. That's the basic. But I can tell you, I've been doing this work since 2006, and I've probably been to, I don't even know, I can't, countless trainings in both mediation and collaboration so that I can continually enhance my skills, because things are constantly evolving and changing, as we know in MFT. We're continuing to educate ourselves every 2 years, not only to get a new license, but to learn and to grow and to develop and be able to offer the best services we can. So what I've described are the basics. And then through your practice groups, you will hopefully join a practice group. You will learn more about networking and educational opportunities that are available around the globe.
I can't thank you enough. You are a wealth of knowledge, as many listeners do after they listen to a podcast like this. They like to continue the dialogue. Randy, tell our listeners the best place to find you or continue the conversation if they choose to do that.
Great. I'd love that. So first, I want to refer you to a professional. His name is Bill Eddy. So Bill Eddy is like the guru of high conflict divorce. Bill Eddy is an MFT. He's also a lawyer. And so he's got a wonderful, generous website out there. I urge you to go to his website. So that's highconflictinstitute.com/our-team. Bill Eddy, E-D-Y. So that's one resource for you. I also urge you to go to David Hoffman's website. He is a Harvard-trained lawyer and mediator, and he is also one of our gurus. He also edited a book called Bringing Peace into the Room. And I urge all of you to go out there and find that book, Bringing Peace into the Room, because whether you're just working as an MFT with couples and families, or you're working as a mediator or a collaborative professional, that will allow you to start having the mindset of how do I enter this room and bring peace into this room as opposed to perpetuating the conflict. So those are two resources I urge you to explore. You can reach me at drrandy@familynetworkflorida.com or drrandy@familynetworknewyork.com. Because I am licensed and I work in Florida, New York, and also Connecticut. Feel free to email me, contact me by phone. I'd be happy to have this conversation with you and further your journey into really, I say, changing the world one family at a time and stopping this cycle of conflict.
Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast. Did you know that AAMFT is active on all your favorite social media channels? Be sure to follow us, the AAMFT, on Instagram, X, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the world of AAMFT? You can always find the back installments of the podcast anywhere you find your favorite podcast. I am partial to Apple Podcast and Spotify, but it's on Google Play, Stitcher. So please, if you're new to us, check out back installments where we tackle the latest trends and events impacting the world of systemic therapy, like today. And I have a number of pioneer interviews, which is some of my favorite interviews to conduct over the years. You can drop me a line at elikaram.com, where you see everything going on in my world, including I have two books that are out, one for our young professionals, Marriage and Family Therapy, National Exam, Your Guide for Success. That's from Springer. And that will prepare you for the national exam, including 360 practice questions, a full-length mock exam, proven strategies and tips for test taking, and it's organized to match the domains of the licensure exam. And then, if you're interested in these common factors that we always talk about on the show, including what makes a motivated client, how you build, nurture, and repair a therapeutic alliance, how you maximize your own therapist factors, you want to check out my book, Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy from Rutledge. As always, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.